Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to say that we have Colin Woodard on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. Europeans are fond of saying, at least fond of saying to me, that there is no American nation. And to a certain extent, of course, this is true. Americans come from all over the place. We are a nation of immigrants. But as Colin Woodard shows in American Nations, there are, in fact, nations in North America. He identifies 11 of them. Some of them you probably know, like the Deep South and New England and the Left Coast, and others you may not. The book is quite surprising in the way that it reorients the ethnic, I guess I would call it, geography of the United States. If you are an American and you read this book, you will learn a little bit more about who you are. If you are not an American and want to know more about North America, then I counsel you to read this book because you will learn quite a bit about the different kinds of North Americans. Colin's analysis does a lot to explain many of the things that have happened in American history from the founding of the Republic through the Civil War to the present. And in that way, it's a very timely book, particularly as we are entering an election year, I guess is what it's going to be. I really enjoyed talking to Colin today. So without further delay, here's the interview. Hi, Colin.
Hello, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine. And yourself?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking. Today we have Colin Woodard on the show, and we'll be talking about his wonderful new book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. I guarantee you that if you live in North America, you will find this book to be very eye-opening. You may think you are, for example, as I did, a Midwesterner and a Kansan. That's where I'm from, Kansas. Or I live in Iowa now, or I'm an Iowan. But what I learned from Colin's book is that this is, to some degree, false. I don't really know who I am. Actually, that doesn't strike me as very odd, that I don't know who I am, because I think many people don't. But in this case, I didn't really understand, how to put it, to what culture I belonged in the United States. And Colin does a really terrific job in this book of sketching the various regional cultures, and they're very large regional cultures, in the United States, explaining their origins and explaining how they work into North American life. And as I should say, it's not just the United States here. We also deal with Canada and Mexico quite extensively, which is a great virtue of this book. It isn't just focused on the United States, but it does take North America as its kind of as its topic. And that again is a wonderful thing to see in a world where the United States can only think about the United States. So anyway, Colin, I congratulate you on the book. Why don't you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a journalist and writer full-time and have been throughout my career self-employed. My career started in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. I was a East European history major as an undergrad. And because of my age, I was in starting in university when Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost reforms were going on. So I was involved in that because it seemed like something big might happen. And lo and behold, during my junior year abroad in Budapest, Hungary, I was fortunate enough to be present in most of the right countries at the right moments to witness the whole unfolding and collapse of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe. So I wanted to keep seeing what was going to happen in these places. It was clear that the centuries of history, which had been on the deep freeze during the communist period, were unthawing, and some of it was going to unthaw unpleasantly.
Well put.
So I came back and was there the next summer on a research grant as an undergrad still in Romania, and then went back and was studying there all through. I went back there and was a journalist there. Based in Budapest and covering everything from Moscow and Petersburg on down to Istanbul and watching it all unfold for most of the 1990s. Went back, I was in graduate school and then went back and covered the aftermath of the Bosnian War just after Dayton. Mm-hmm. And continue to go back to that region. But I'm a foreign correspondent is really where my career and foundations were, and then came back to the United States in the late 90s and was based in D.C. and was a a roving global affairs reporter, covering some stuff in DC for the Christian Science Monitor, but also traveling regularly. You know, every month I was somewhere else. Did a book about the collapse of the world's large marine ecosystems. Was my first book, which drew. It was about people too, and how it was affecting communities. I spent a year traveling everywhere from Antarctica to these little micro states in the middle of the Pacific that believe they're going to disappear because of rising sea levels, to Newfoundland and the Grand Banks and the Black Sea, and learned to scuba dive and was in Belize.
Lucky devil, you.
All over the place. A fascinating project to do. But also a sort of global project. It was drawing in not just environment and science, but bonding it to sort of journalism, history, sociology, and sort of the relationship of different communities and people to the resource that they were seeing falling apart.
Liberal arts in practice.
This is my entire life is the liberal arts. Yeah, applied liberal arts major.
Applied kind liberal
of
arts.
Yeah, I'm everywhere. So followed that up with a book on my home state, which is Maine, and the coast of my home state, which is a place with a very identifiable and idiosyncratic local culture. Somewhat suspicious of outsiders, particularly if they happen to be from our neighbor, Massachusetts. and this is an exploration of our cultural identity and also our marine resources. So it was drawing together the real history of what shaped our unusual culture that, you know, I'm from, and where it sort of put us today. In a sense, it's American Nations writ small, I'm happy to say an extremely popular book in this little part of the world. And then that was when I was first confronting U.S. colonial history in some detail. And it was to probe Maine's identity and its relationship to the Massachusetts Puritan experiment and annexation and sort of post-colonial history that it has required really delving into the colonial period in our country. You know, I'd been busy dealing with, you know, the Byzantines and Habsburgs when I was an undergrad. So, you know, I figured I knew Maine and New England history at least because, you know, we had to take that in school. We even had an entire unit in junior high school on Maine history. Oh my gosh. I mean, as you and many listeners of this podcast know, the colonial period in American history is absolutely nothing like the sort of received mythological version that at least in the 70s and 80s I received in public school. You know, that version where, you know, the pilgrims, you know, the Mayflower arrives and disgorges the pilgrims at Plymouth Rock. And whoa, fast forward, it's the French and Indian War and the Revolution. Mm-hmm. You know, wow, what happened to that 150 years in between? Mm-hmm. It tends to be skipped over because if you're trying to tell a history of a place called the United States and somehow tie the creation of a unitary, you know, superpower, you know, united from sea to sea, indivisible, yada yada, to the colonial period, it's an impossible task because nothing adds up. It's confusing and messy, and in fact, you know, as the current book talks about, there's it's the wrong way of looking at our history and our identity. Mm-hmm. So that was when I was first really digging into it and realizing, you know, we're really, you know, there are several Americas, and the book I followed up on. In between all this, I'm doing journalism all sorts and traveling back to Eastern Europe and covering the Icelandic, you know, financial collapse and Korea in 97 and, you know, doing roving the planet, going to Greenland and, you know, doing stuff. So this is part of my mix. But then the next book project, the previous book, which came out in 2007, was a, I guess, my first back to archives and vellum kind of history. this is on the Great Caribbean Pirates. There's this one gang, it's called Republic of Pirates, and there's this one gang of pirates who are responsible for 90% of all that pop culture, you know, imagery about pirates. You know, these arg, lovable rogue, you know, who are going off to, you know, live a married life and a short one, and it's all sort of about freedom, and somehow, even though they're absolute criminals and terrorists, we seem to like them. You know, where did that come from?
There's that criminal and terrorist part that people forget.
Yeah,
they see Johnny Depp and they don't.
Exactly. Yeah. But why is that the case? And it turns out because they were heroes at the time.
Yeah.
And in fact, if there was this one clique of guys surrounding Blackbeard, and Sam Bellamy was part of it, Steve Bonnet, Mary Read, Anne Bonny, Calico Jack Rackham, much of our pantheon of pirates happened to all be associated with one another, operated as one clique for just a 5-year period out of the Bahamas. And they were so successful and so unusual and unlike previous generations of pirates and the pirates who've come since, that they had a sort of lasting resonance. They were heroes at the time and for good reason, actually. So it's a fascinating story that's totally unlike, again, the received wisdom and was set in the colonial period. But I was originally doing it because I was trying to figure out, you know, how could you pull a mass audience into this colonial period of American history that nobody understands? And it's like, well, dinosaurs won't work, but pirates work. So I was just going to use the pirate, right? My own devices. But
we've got to talk after the show about how to work dinosaurs in somehow, because they really are a great hook.
but the pirate story ended up being so absolutely unusual and unlike the received wisdom that, you know, I ended up getting hooked on this particular pirate grouping's actual story. And this, to reconstruct what these people's lives really were, because the mythic history and the secondhand history has come to dominate things, it was this, you know, incredible treasure hunt of, you know, spreadsheets and triangulating data and going to the National Archives in Kew outside of London, where most of the stuff from the English-speaking colonial world ended up, most of the originals, and finding, tracking the Royal Navy captains of obscure ships stationed in the Americas, whose job was to collect intelligence and track these guys. Nobody had really ever looked at their stuff, at the original letters of these captains of small sloops of war that happened to be in interesting locations at interesting times, who are collecting intelligence, and you can track where they were because the ship's logs are identifying their longitude and latitude and what the weather was like. And you know, you start, they encounter other people who end up being additional sources. And anyway, I was able to piece together a far more you know, detailed picture than people had previously seen. I got very hooked on that, digging in the archives and finding what no historian has seen before kind of stuff is an awful lot of fun. And gosh, you go to the National, I mean, try to go to the, you know, the Library of Congress and ask them to see something from the 19th century. And, you know, they give you a background check and send you through a scanner and put white gloves on you. And, you know, don't you dare breathe on this thing. Not so at the National Archives in Kew. I mean, you ask for Captain Woods Rogers, who circumnavigated the, you know, the world in 1713, his original boxes of his logbooks still, you know, stained with the salt water that splashed over the rail while he was writing them, you know, trying to go around the southern tip of South America. They just hand them to you. Oh, here you go. Knock yourself out, you know. Oh, aren't you worried I'm going to hurt these things? Oh, that stuff's from the early 1700s. We got loads of it out back. You know, we're worried about the Magna Carta, you know. You know, they don't consider it old, if you know what I mean.
Yes, so I do.
It's pretty wonderful to be able to be given intimate access to things like that. And I mean, they're wonderfully efficient and stuff, but the sort of democracy of access is pretty wonderful for something coming from the New World.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's my book career, and I'm based in Maine now, which is where I'm from, and until recently I've been still traveling and doing foreign correspondent-y things, but of late have been digging in, becoming, for lack of anyone else doing it around, and I have the skill set. I also, on the side, I'm sort of the investigative journalist, you know, the feared Cy Hirsch figure in Maine, because there's nobody doing it and all the newspaper staff's been cut back. So it falls on me to be the watchdog, keeping track of our governor and posting and digging up campaign finance disclosures and elections and, you know, all that nitty gritty. So sort of like going to the National Archives in Kew, except now it's sort of the current affairs equivalent, you know, hitting people with records requests and exposing appalling relationships between lobbyists and politicians and legislation and all that, all that fun stuff, which is again not unrelated to the historian's quest and in my liberal arts framework, you know, keeps frenetically grabbing disciplines and slamming them together.
Well, it sounds like a pretty good gig and definitely a public-spirited one. I think the people of Maine probably would thank you for what you're doing. I know I would if I were in Maine.
Roughly 2/3 of them. The other third would like to
lynch you. Send you to Massachusetts.
Yes, perhaps.
Anyway, Colin, tell us how you came to write this book.
So, as we've discussed here, I've believe that the colonial period was, you know, is essential to people understanding our history. And what the lesson really boils down to me, and has, you know, I've been thinking about this for, you know, for 20 years, you know, I've been thinking about the deep fissures, culturally speaking, that don't match state or international boundaries in the Balkans and Eastern Europe, which often tragically shape their history. But at least in the Balkans and Eastern Europe, people know their history for better or worse. Here, the same cultural forces are affecting political behavior and the national discussion, and indeed today the national paralysis. And they always have these deep fissures between regions, and they all grow out of the fact that the original clusters of colonies, and I think this is the great lesson of colonial history that's missed, were settled as essentially as separate countries. I mean, mm-hmm. they weren't coming to create an America. They were coming to create, you know, a world, a Chesapeake world, and a New England world, and a Dutch founded experiment on Manhattan Island that spread up the Hudson River, and mm-hmm. and in Barbadian planters from the West Indies and the lowlands of the South, and so on and so forth. Those were separate experiments, each with their own intents and ideals and societal goals and expectations and models. They were separate regional cultures, or indeed nations in the European sense of being stateless nations and people sharing or believing they share a common culture and rituals and all that. I mean, they have the distinctions and the characteristics between them are as profound, and I would say more disparate than between the countries of the European Union. I mean, there is very little that the Deep South as a regional culture and Greater New England as a regional culture can agree on. And in fact, they never have.
Yeah.
And that fractured nature, because they expanded, that they developed through much of the colonial period in rather profound isolation from one another. And they ended up expanding through the early 19th century in mutually exclusive bands, both for environmental reasons and because of soil and what crops would grow that each folkway was accustomed to, but also because they were actively avoiding one another. Mm-hmm. They found each other impossible to live with, so they would mm-hmm. self-sorted. And because of that, there's, you know, they sort of laid down the cultural DNA, as it were, of separate sections of the eastern half of the country. And in the southern rim, the northern borderlands of New Spain, did the same for parts of the American Southwest, but, you know, more on that later.
Mm-hmm.
But that's essentially, if you roll that forward through our history and you start recognizing these fault lines and this paradigm, it makes everything a lot clearer. Mm-hmm. And by everything, I mean the battle lines, regionally speaking, and the way the American Revolution was fought, the arguments at the First Continental Congress, the contradictions within the U.S. Constitution of 1789, the War of 1812's regional divisions, and the run-up to the Civil War. I mean, people go to great intellectual gymnastics to create a Highland South and a Lowland South and a Border North and a Border South. No, they're separate regional cultures that don't follow the state boundaries that mm-hmm. behaved with incredible internal consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, right up to today, which is what most interviewers are interested in, because it can plays out on the blue county, red county maps, and in mm-hmm. our culture war since the 60s. And it's the key to really understanding who we are and why we have these circular arguments about key issues, about what American values are and have been and should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I quite agree with you. I think that most people who have traveled around the United States extensively and lived in various parts of it, and I have lived in all of them, know this intuitively, that in fact, these regional cultures exist, and they are quite distinct and different from one another. I don't think it's well reflected in the press, but I think people know it in their bones.
Yeah, I think subconsciously everyone's aware of this, and they're also aware that they don't follow state boundary lines.
No, they do not. They absolutely
every Marylander
do not, yeah.
knows there's three Marylands and can probably tell you exactly where the divisions are. I mean, you know that there are two Kansases.
There are definitely two Kansases, yes.
Kansans know that, and
yeah.
Texans, you know, may thump their chest about Texas, but and know that the capital's in Austin, but they're all aware that Houston and Dallas and San Antonio are the hubs of three very different Texases.
Yeah, yeah.
You could go on, you know, upstate Illinois and downstate and on.
Yeah.
Upstate.
Yeah. Northern California, Southern California.
Yeah, and especially
Western Mass, Eastern Mass.
Yeah, less so if you really get down to, because the Yankee culture is strong. But yeah, at another time, you know, another resolution level, you can go down to the conflicts between Maine and Massachusetts. But hey, in the end, we were conquered and absorbed into the Puritan experiment, mm-hmm. and have more in common with our imperial brethren in Massachusetts Bay than we do. We have more in common than we do with any other part of the country. So you see it in our architecture, in our political institutions, and our cultural values, you know, whether we like it or not.
My wife is from Massachusetts, and as I say, I'm from what I call the Plain States. That's what I always call it. People call it the Midwest, but I say, no, not really. It's the Plain States. That's what I always called it. And we have quite different, let's say, cultural habits or cultural instincts. They're really very different. I hadn't realized it until we had kids, and then it really came into play. How different our assumptions were about the way things should be done and what the kind of realities of the world were. But, you know, we work them out, but they're very different.
Interesting, yeah. I would imagine that might play out on a family level.
Yeah, it really has. It's a peculiar thing. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about these regions and their histories. Unlike most reviewers, I'm not entirely interested in what's going on today, because this is, after all, New Books in History. So let's talk about some of the origins of some of these places. And again, I said in the introduction, I was particularly pleased to find out that you had included all of North America, which is very nice. So let's talk about El Norte. What is El Norte?
Sure, that would be the first one, chronologically speaking, of the Euro-American cultures to be laid down, and indeed starting in the late 1500s. It's the Spanish borderlands, the northern frontiers of Spain's empire in the Americas. Today, Americans are well aware that the southwestern bits of the country, the southern California, the southernmost parts of Arizona, most of New Mexico, and the southern strip, more or less, of Texas, are a place apart where Hispanic cultural norms and language and food ways and stuff are dominant. And that's pretty obvious. What's less understood by Americans is that that region, including the northern tier of provinces in Mexico, the northern Mexico and what has become part of the United States, have always been looked upon by Mexicans from the rest of the country as a place apart. Mm-hmm. That people from the north, norteños, are stereotyped as being more independent and work-centered and democratically inclined than people from central Mexico and the south. And the people from the north were spearheading the Mexican Revolution and many other reform movements throughout the country's history. They've often resented their relationship with the rest of Mexico and the Mexican center, and because of that were involved in numerous secession movements during the Mexican period, the Republic of the Rio Grande, and indeed the Republic of Texas. The Republic of Texas, when it achieved independence from Mexico, it wasn't just Austin and other Anglos, in quotes, who were leading it. It was the entire Norteño Spanish-speaking elite of Texas were with them. They were partners. They all wanted to secede from Mexico. It's just that the Spanish-speaking elite in Texas was not planning on being annexed by the United States. They were going to be a third state, a buffer state between the two, because they'd always been that. Economically, in many ways, they were oriented to and had similarities with the U.S. more so than Mexico in a lot of the ways that they conducted themselves and their trade patterns throughout their history. So it's a separate culture from both countries and a distinct one with a long history of regional identity. Mm-hmm. And today I think it has a lot of parallels to Germany during the Cold War, a single culture divided by a political boundary and a large wall. Mm-hmm. And so there's the fact that a lot of people worry, Samuel Huntington was extremely concerned about the threat to American identity by the rapid increase in Mexican immigration, particularly in the southwest of the country, and that this was going to undermine and destroy core American, alleged Anglo-Protestant culture and values, because nobody was assimilating and taking on. They didn't need to take on the English language and our culture because they could live embedded in an entirely Mexican culture and institutions within our own country, and that this was threatening. But the thing is, in that part of the world, it was founded and set up from New Spain. It had always been that way. It was only during a century or so long interlude where it was conquered as an imperial project, and much of it, sort of race-based caste system was imposed where Hispanic people weren't allowed to participate equally in politics and such. I mean, look at that, you know, that movie Giant was all about that. Yeah. And the decomposing of that system. You know, that was a anomalous period in the middle of it, much like in, you know, you could draw parallels with New France, with Quebec. Same thing. It was conquered, and for a long period of time, it was difficult if you were Francophone to participate actively in the British-dominated Lower Canada. But after the 1960s, they sort of were able to seize controls of the culture and the politics. And similarly, the same thing has sort of happened in El Norte. So that's that in a long nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's interesting you put it in the way you put it, because it does, I think, cast American political activity, and particularly the what we might call the activity of the Fed, that is Washington and whoever controls it, in a different light. Because these attempts at Americanization, for example, after the Mexican-American War, were really led by an alliance between what I guess we might call Anglos in El Norte and Washington itself. And this occurs again and again in American history. At some point, the Fed gets very interested in dampening these regional differences. And from the perspective of Washington, this is an attempt to uphold American values somehow, or protect America's borders. And from the perspective of the people who are bearing the brunt of Washington's attempt to quote-unquote Americanize these regions, it just seems like some sort of regional war. And this is particularly true in the South, where these people were really looked at as foreigners. These foreigners are coming down here, and they're trying to change our culture. I think the same thing, to some extent, is felt in El Norte today. I mean, anybody who's been down there knows that it's quite different and distinct than the rest of the United States. It just isn't like every place else.
Yeah, and I lived in Brownsville, Texas for a year and a half, which is about it's one part of El Norte where there's always been an overwhelming 90% majority Hispanic.
Yeah, Brownsville.
They settled there and run the show almost the entire time.
And they have great beaches.
They do have great beaches, absolutely. A different attitude towards littering than we have in New England.
No, they do. Yeah, that's right. Beaches. Yeah, they do. Yeah, no, it's true. It's very different. So let's move on to the second oldest, I think, I guess, I'm not sure, but also culturally very distinct because it has a linguistic difference, and that is New France.
Absolutely. What's the settled a few years, 1604 was the original attempt at settlement, and it's from the times of Champlain onwards. It's a unusual culture. Yes, it was settled by the French, but it Champlain had the idea that the French settlements and the indigenous people they encountered in the St. Lawrence Valley and what's become New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, the Acadia, were to interact as partners. And while he was coming from the France of the era of the Sun King, Louis XIV, mm-hmm. with a centralized aristocratic system, and indeed internally his within the French camps, the lords and aristocrats ate one set of food and didn't even seem to know the names of the rest of the people, but they treated the Indian chiefs as their co-equal mm-hmm. aristocrats. And invited them for great feasts, and mm-hmm. they would be served by the peons. But that was the model, was a model of cultural exchange and on equal participation level, and that they would work cooperatively with these groups and seemed to have little problem with taking on and sharing cultural elements and technologies, and even having the sons of aristocrats go take wives from the chiefs' families and create cross-racial unions at a time, where many of the other regional cultures would have looked at this as the most appalling thing you could possibly do. Mm-hmm. The French experiment in North America embraced many of those things. Now, the result was a resounding defeat for Louis XIV's original project to just recreate the French feudal model in the St. Lawrence Valley. Instead, what they ended up with was a hybrid culture blending the folkways of northern French peasantry and the Ancien Régime with those of the indigenous people they encountered in the St. Lawrence Valley, a hybrid culture, mm-hmm. Where people did not want to stay and work their lord's land. A lot of them would just run off and go native, as it were, go mm-hmm. join the Indians in their camps and mm-hmm. and become woodcutters and have families that were it turned out that the folkways of many of these peasants and the values of the Aboriginal people they came among had a lot of similarities. They got along pretty well. Mm-hmm. And so you had this sort of blending of cultures, and they brought on board this idea, which has become a very Canadian idea that comes from New France, of the sort of continuous negotiation, that you work towards cooperative solutions in a negotiation and dialogue without end. Mm-hmm. Which is a sort of stereotypical Canadian thing today, but was brought forth from the culture of New France and sort of has infected Canadian federal politics in a mm-hmm. profound way. Mm-hmm. So it's, very different from France itself mm-hmm. in the culture that evolved there. And again, like we mentioned, it was conquered after the French and Indian War became a sort of subject part of the British Empire, and it's only since the 1960s, as in El Norte, with a quiet revolution in Quebec, that the new French culture has seized full control over its destiny in politics, mm-hmm. and indeed created in Quebec a sort of nation state in waiting that almost seceded several times mm-hmm. and instituted distinct what they considered a superior social model of civilization and strong welfare state and strong state involvement in private enterprise, including big energy companies like Hydro-Quebec. And it's a very Europeanish model that was completely alien to Canada at the time it happened and has since had an effect on some of the other parts of Canada. But nobody would argue it's not a distinct society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, this still exists in the United States to some extent in Louisiana. And I'm thinking particularly of the way in which, and I know very little about this, I confess, the way in which politics in Louisiana is structured. They have a kind of it's odd in the American context.
Yeah, they got a parish system.
Yeah, the parish system. We don't have that. We didn't have that in Kansas. What is the parish system?
Well, it's they still use elements of the Napoleonic code in their legal system as opposed to English common law. I mean, the new French enclave has not had control over the levers of power of all of Louisiana since the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, it was purchased. It was part of France, which is why when the British decided to ethnically cleanse the French out of the defeated province of Acadia, which is outside of Quebec and in what's now New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, they evicted many of the people, mm-hmm. and a lot of them, the refugees, ended up in French Louisiana, and which quickly ended up changing hands and becoming part of the United States.
Yep.
But they have had an influence, but they don't fully control all the levers of power in Louisiana or anywhere else because the immigration from the Deep South and Greater Appalachia ended up outnumbering them, particularly the Deep South. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. New Orleans is kind of an interesting blend of Deep Southern and New French culture and undoubtedly the greater Caribbean culture, which this book doesn't try to tackle mm-hmm, as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you've been down there, it's a very distinct place. It's not like any other place in the United States. I mean, I just don't think the people who haven't traveled a lot realize this. Maybe they do. I don't know. But
New Orleans is so different from any other city in the Deep South,
yeah,
too.
It is. in a big way. It really is. So let's move on because, you know, we have a lot of territory to cover. What is the Tidewater? What do you mean by Tidewater? I think many people won't know what that is.
I'll cover these a little faster for
time that's fine. Purposes,
now that we're getting into more familiar territory. The mm-hmm. Tidewater is around the Chesapeake country. It was settled by the younger sons of English gentry. The the dominant culture was really formed in the second half of the 1600s, and they were coming on an eminently conservative project. They wished to recreate the English manorial system of the English countryside circa 1660 in the Chesapeake country. And these are the second and third and fourth sons of English gentry, so they're the ones who weren't going to inherit anything. And this was their opportunity, a second chance to actually create a manorial estate, and it was on this sort of Enlightenment model of they are the head of the household and everyone else are literally the hands, and that there's some kind of social contract between the lord and his peons, and the lord will enlightenedly run everything for the good of everybody else, and everybody else should know their place in society. So it's inherently hierarchical and conservative, it was quite successful. I mean, through into the early 1700s, they really did reproduce, even though it was a completely different environment, the genteel world of the English countryside, where there weren't really any cities. I mean, you had St. Mary's City in Maryland, the capital, and Williamsburg. They were essentially government campuses built on centralized and models with all kinds of Enlightenment symbols, but they were empty when things were out of session. You didn't need cities. You didn't need ports. You just had ships, ocean-going ships. You just come up the creeks, tie up at your dock, and your little self-sufficient universe. You made, you know, you had staff, and you tried to operate pretty much lumber operations and growing your own food supplies, and you sort of each one was its own little world unto itself. And you exported what you needed to back to London, and imported what you needed from your merchants there, and just as people in the countryside would. In fact, it was often cheaper for you to send stuff to London than it was for people who had to send it overland from some of the English countryside itself. So it has always remained a place with more emphasis on hierarchy and tradition, and not a lot of emphasis on sort of a quality of station. And then thereafter, if we keep moving chronologically, you have Yankeedom, which is one of the big superpowers of the 11 nations. It was, of course, founded on the shores of Massachusetts Bay by Puritans and radical Calvinists who were coming there to create a applied religious utopia.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should say about these people that they were peculiar even in the English and European context.
Absolutely.
They were very odd.
They were not, you know, there was England was key, you know, cantering and towards the English Civil War, and
I mean, if people think that, you know, apropos Mitt Romney, that Mormons aren't like the rest of us, they should read about the Puritans.
Well, no,
they really weren't like the rest of us.
The Mormons also are an eminently Yankee phenomenon. Yeah. I mean, they're founded by Yankees in Yankeedom, and like I'm going to describe with the Puritans, were engaged in a mission to create a more perfect world on earth. They were going to create, by their own, you know, estimation, a more godly society. And they were going to do that through what we today would call active social engineering by public institutions. It was community-based. You know, they were. It's no accident that the Puritan church evolved into the Congregational Church, because it was all about congregations. With each congregation, no bishops and archbishops above them. Each town was to maintain its own institutions and town meetings and govern itself, because the key was to keep the community, and the community was defined as, you know, sets of local communities, free. And the freedom of the community and the good of the community required individual sacrifice and self-denial, which are very New England and very Yankee ideas that are considered alien and un-American by many of the other regional cultures. And the reason for that is if everyone got to do whatever they want and exercise personal freedom, while some of you people are going to emerge as tyrants, becoming aristocrats or what have you, lording over the rest of us and depriving the community of its freedom. So it's all about the sort of common good trumping the individual's freedom of movement and latitude, if necessary. And indeed, that's carried through in sort of a secular Puritan mission that the Yankees have always been on the front of many of our great moral crusades throughout history, from the fight against slavery to the fight against drinking to and so on and so forth. And they spread their culture. Yankeedom is much larger than New England. It spread across upstate New York and the Western Reserve of Ohio and on up into most of the upper Great Lakes states. Those were all founded, in the case of much of upstate New York and Western Reserve of Ohio, those are places claimed by Massachusetts or Connecticut. And in court settlements, sovereignty was given to New York State and the new state of Ohio, but the New Englanders actually owned the land and guided settlement of it, moving people as entire communities, often led by their congregational minister, with leaving with blessings and sometimes writing Mayflower-like compacts for what they would do on arrival. They, you know, it was a parallel of the journey of the Winthrop fleet to found a new Zion, a light on the hill of Massachusetts. They were doing the same to save the West for Yankeedom and Calvinism. And this would there would even be an attempt to do so on the Pacific. So there many of the religious orthodoxy of Yankeedom collapsed long ago, but not the underlying sense of sort of a mission to improve the world here and the emphasis on sort of communal good as opposed to individual freedom, which is very different than some of the other cultures. Just south of there, New Netherland, the area, the Big Apple, the area around New York City, was founded not by the English at all, but by the Dutch and in the early 1600s, and was modeled very much on Amsterdam and the Netherlands at home at the time. And in that era, the Netherlands was the most it sophisticated state in the Western world. They'd already thrown off a king generations before, the King of Spain, and created a free trading republic. It was a global trading society, commercial and multi-ethnic and multi-religious, and founded on the notion of extreme notion of tolerance of difference and of freedom of inquiry. I mean, it's no accident that a lot of the great revolutionary thinkers of that time period, they all published their works in Amsterdam because they would have been arrested at home if they'd done so. And Amsterdam in the 1600s was the seat of global trade and banking and currency exchange and publishing, and a refuge for people from those oppressed in other cultures of Europe to flee to. Ditto from the very beginning in New Amsterdam and what became New York City. It had all those characteristics. And indeed, New York City today has all of those characteristics. It's remained a place very different from the rest of North America, a global trading society with not a lot of emphasis on sort of great moral issues of the day. I mean, there's extreme tolerance of owning slaves, you know, and no sense of one cultural group being dominant, more of a commercial free-for-all with many points of view and the freedom of inquiry tolerated. It's been a world city very, very early on, and it attractive to immigrants for many of these same reasons. You move a little south from there to the Midlands. This is the grew out of Philadelphia and the Delaware Valley. This is a culture originally founded by William Penn and English Quakers. In short, the Quakers believed in people had an inner light and the inherent goodness of humans, and they therefore were much more open to and less threatened by the idea of otherness and people coming in, because everyone in the end would do right. And so they had a open door immigration policy to a large degree, and that resulted very quickly in a characteristic Midland culture, which is multi-ethnic, multilingual, multi-religious, a sort of mosaic, a checkerboard of cultures living side by side in neighborhoods or even in farming villages out in the agricultural areas, where each culture and language is being practiced as you wish. No attempt. There's no common culture. The genius of it is that everybody is able to live side by side and don't bother us. You know, government should leave us alone, and you should leave each other alone. Creating it could be politically apathetic on the big issues of the day, and skeptical of government intervention in a way Yankees never would be, but shared with the Yankees a middle class ethos. You know, society is to be structured around the needs of sort of ordinary, hardworking people out there in the farms or the burghers of the towns. And that culture spread through parts of Pennsylvania and on through stretches of the middle parts of Ohio and the northern part of Indiana and on spreading out fan-like into parts of the Midwest, that sort of middle America we think of in the Midwest.
Yeah. I mean, this was it was an extraordinarily successful model in terms of bringing, I guess what I would call reasonably accomplished groups of people to the United States and setting them up. I'm thinking of my own genealogy on my mother's side. I believe they were Germans in the 1830s who came to Ohio, and there were lots of Germans that came in the 1830s to Ohio, and they lived in a separate German community, a German-speaking community that slowly anglicized over a couple of generations. But they, you know, they were farmers and merchants, and they still are. And then when they moved further west in my family, they moved to Nebraska and then to Kansas. They did the same things, and they took their churches with them. They were Lutheran churches, and they went places and they set places up. I mean, anybody who's been to the Midwest, I mean, one of the mistakes about the Midwest that I think one of the misconceptions people have is that it's homogenous, and it just isn't. It is homogenizing, I would say, but you know, you'll find lots of places where there are Swedes and there are Calvinists and there are Lutherans and there are Germans, and thanks to Prairie Home Companion, we know a little bit about Norwegians now, and there really are all these people. You know, in Kansas, for example, there are African American communities. Nicodemus is one, and it does have this ethos of you go set yourself up there on the prairie, and you tend to your own, and you'll just be fine. And it really is ethnically quite diverse. I just think people in the United States don't realize that it is. There are so many different kinds of people. In that strip, I was very interested in the map because it does run from Pennsylvania all the way really to the Midwest. And I'd never really thought of it like that. But if you drive across I-80, you know, it's kind of a piece. You really can tell. You stop one place and it's quite like the one that came before. And I really like that map. I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, and different. I mean, I argue there really isn't a Midwest, that there's, you know, there's a Midlands Midwest, a Yankee Midwest, and an Appalachian Midwest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they have very different characteristics, and indeed visitors traveling in these places from the 19th century onwards saw marked differences between, you know, north of this road and south of this road in architecture, and who was these parts of the Midwest were being settled from separate streams, each originating in a different coastal base of one of these regional cultures.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It is very interesting in that way, because if you look at the settlement of places like southern Ohio, places like Ohio in general, and Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, northern Missouri, they really are sort of entire separate communities are coming there from usually from Europe and setting up. And they maintain their religions, and they on the Penn model, you know, they maintain their religions and they maintain their ways of life for quite a long time.
Pluralistic Midlander behavior, perhaps not true in the Ozarks of Missouri.
No, it's not. I actually lived in Fayetteville, Arkansas. I lived in Arkansas, and I can tell you. Well, anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's a separate culture. I mean, the Midlands attracted – the Midlands, New Netherland, and Yankeedom attracted virtually all of the immigration from the Great Waves to the eastern half of the country. Mm-hmm. And immigrants did not essentially go – almost didn't go, period, in the 19th century Great Waves to the to Tidewater and the next two cultures I'm going to mention, Greater Appalachian, the Deep South. So that instantly creates a very different attitude towards American identity. And while we're on it, I mean, the Midlands, you know, it's the ethnic mosaic you're describing is the key. And therefore, the genius of the country is its sort of pluralism, right? But it's from Yankeedom that we get this idea that, no, we're a melting pot, an Anglo-Protestant melting pot, where the ideal, as per Samuel Huntington, who was, you know, Yankee Harvard, was that immigrants would come in and assimilate into our culture. Thus, you know, Henry Ford in Yankee Detroit had in schools for his immigrant employees to virtuously, you know, teach them the Protestant work ethic and the and our ways in hygiene, and at the end of English, and at the end of their graduation from these special schools, the families would be invited, and they'd have a stage there and a gigantic papier-mâché melting pot, and the workers would come marching out onto the stage wearing their national costumes, their respective national costumes. They'd walk behind the melting pot, and their teachers would be up above stirring the melting pot. Yeah. Literally, and then the workers would come out on the other side to great applause, all wearing identical American, in quote, suits.
Yeah.
I mean, it was assimilation to the common culture. And you hear both of those arguments as, you know, here's an example of the dysfunctional argument, because you'll hear arguments about what is American identity and what should our attitude towards immigration be, and both the pluralistic ethnic mosaic camp and the assimilative melting pot camp both argue that those are fundamental values and give all sorts of sightings from history. But that, they're both American values, but from different Americas. you know, that one is a Midlander concept embraced also in New Netherland, another is a Yankee concept. I mean, so and the idea that foreigners, you know, that somehow everyone should be, you know, look like us and act like us is much stronger in the cultures that had no mass immigration in the 19th century in the southern parts. So you see that played out in the Midwestern communities as well, I would imagine.
It's interesting you mentioned Huntington. He's a good example. I spent quite a bit of time, about 10 years, in that Cambridge environment where he lived. And there was always this notion there that somehow they were a national institution, and so they understood the entire nation. But it was just very clear that someone like Huntington did not. He did not understand these other places. He had never been to them. He had never lived in them. He didn't know anyone from them. I mean, his generation, things have changed there now. Obviously, a lot of people from other parts of the United States. But, you know, the Harvard that he lived in his whole life was comprised of people just like him. I mean, you know, one of my advisors there used to say they would just, you know, back a truck up to Choate, and they'd just haul the kids in, and that was it. You know, they all had gone to the same right. They had all gone to the same churches, and their fathers knew each other, and they were, you know, they thought of themselves as this is America, and there really isn't any other America because they hadn't met anyone else. And the provincialism of people, of many people, they're not everyone there, but the provincialism of someone like Huntington is just is really very striking to me as a Midwesterner who is in that context. That, you know, these things that you hear about the Midwest that are just bizarre to you, like it's ethnically homogeneous, just bizarre.
Absolutely, and its effect on our historiography has been profound because in the aftermath of the Civil War, when we were trying to figure out, okay, South has been defeated and supposedly we're going to reconstruct them, you know, to be like us, but to be like Yankees, how do we create a historical narrative of unity for the second half of the 19th century? And so many of our great, you know, classic, you know, Parkman kind of histories were created then by Harvard and Yale Yankees. The whole mythic history that we received and still has echoes in, at least outside of the academy, in what people sort of receive in grade school, was a narrative in which the Puritans and Pilgrims arrived in Massachusetts and laid the groundwork for America. And, you know, don't pay too much attention to Jamestown or those fishermen who were already living in the main settlements. Right. And, you know, forget the other regional cultures that it springs out of the first Thanksgiving and all of that imagery. Total bollocks, right? Bollocks.
It doesn't. Thanksgiving is physically funny.
They even, you know, changed quotes and things that they've since been, you know, caught doing to aggrandize their history. And not only were they talking about their region, they were aggrandizing their own gene pool who were involved in these things.
Yeah, no, it's true.
So yes, I mean, what you're saying is true, and it has a long history. That's, you know, it's the Yankee project having, you know, the early Puritans had enormous emphasis and respect for intellectual achievement and education. Their leaders weren't aristocrats. They were the educated people, and that's why they set up Harvard really early. Mm-hmm. But that also meant it was the intellectual capital of the country. And at a time in the late 19th century where the Yankees thought they'd finally vanquished their foes and would have control of the country again as they hadn't had since John Adams' presidency, that here was a chance to, you know, save the country for Yankee Calvinist values and that historical project that's still with us. And like you say, right up into our lifetimes, many of the great historians out of that universe still kind of do have those odd cultural blinders sometimes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is always remarkable to me when I go back east and I talk to, you know, my relatives, my wife's brothers and aunts and uncles and things like this, to talk to them about the Midwest. And, you know, they're one generation removed from the Midwest, but they've been completely Yankeeized now, and they see the world from that place. And I don't, which isn't to say I don't agree with them about, you know, I agree with them 90% of the time, but it is, I always feel very, I don't know how to say it, but I don't feel exactly at home there. You know,
I feel a cultural gap at work.
I do. I just really feel it at work, and I just can't quite put my finger on it, but it's definitely there. And also the provincialism was very striking to me when I first went back east, and I saw it there. Not so much in California. I went to graduate school in California, and I felt that it was much more similar to the Midwest in that way because they don't just talk about celebrating diversity. They live it. Whereas I think on the East Coast, they talk about celebrating diversity, but they don't live it. They don't have it. So,
well, in the Yankee part, there's still that notion of quietly of assimilation somewhere in there. I mean, that in small town Maine, for instance, I mean, you're – you're quietly expected as newcomers to come and start, you know, figure out what's going on around you and behave accordingly. You know, that's just kind of the default assumption of our culture.
Right.
Which is totally different than other parts of the country.
I mean, not to beat a dead horse, but, my wife's family is from Northampton, Massachusetts, and there's just no more, quote-unquote, enlightened liberal place. And we live here in Iowa City. But you go to Northampton, and if you were a foreigner, you were from Mars, you would say, these are the most homogeneous people I have ever seen in my life. They all drive Priuses. They all look exactly the same. They all went to the same schools. They all have the same tastes. There are no black people, and there are very few Hispanics. But yet, these people are, the sort of paragon of American enlightenment. They're fine people. I really love them, and I love going back there. In fact, we're moving there. But it just, to me, I tell people where I went to high school, this is in Kansas, that we had a very large number of Vietnamese people who went to my high school. Mm-hmm. And they look at me like, how? I'm like, you hear the boat people? That's where they went because we took them. That's where they went because we were used to this. Churches sponsored them and they came to Kansas and we educated them and now they're citizens of our place, just like we, came here, many hundreds of years ago and set up shop, or like the Hmong community in Minnesota, similar sort of thing. I don't know. Just one of the things about Midwesterners I have noticed, and you can kind of hear it in my voice, is a certain defensiveness. We feel a little bit hard done here by the late 20th century. So I apologize for that. But anyway, I definitely want to get to the last two or three or four regions that we have to deal with. We're almost running out of time. So let's talk a little about the Deep South.
Well, quickly, So the Deep South was founded a couple of generations after the Puritans arrived in Massachusetts Bay by an entirely different group of people, and the Deep South is the other superpower that throughout history since the U.S. was created has faced off against Yankeedom, forming coalitions on almost every major internally divisive event we've had has featured one coalition led by Yankeedom versus another in the Deep South, including the Civil War. So the Deep South was settled by the sort of antithesis of the Yankees. It was English planters from the plantation island of Barbados in the late 1600s who were grafting into the deep southern lowlands a fully formed West Indian slave society. Mm-hmm. Unlike the Tidewater, where the English gentry in the Tidewater were trying to create manorial feudalism, they couldn't find anyone to play the role of peasants. They started bringing indentured servants, and over 80 years that didn't work. They segued right into eventually full on slavery. But in the Deep South, it happened generations later, and was a fully formed horrific gang system. I mean, Barbados at the time, and this is in the 1600s when slavery was existed all over the place. Barbados was seen as absolutely horrifying by its English contemporaries for its disregard for human life, where it was cheaper to just work people to death because sugar was so incredibly valuable than it was to conserve and take care of your enslaved labor supply. And they became staggeringly wealthy. They were the nouveau riche of that time period, who were coming back to England and just buying titles and estates. As John Locke wrote of them, the Barbadians endeavor to rule all. Mm-hmm. And the Barbadians came to the Deep South and recreated it was originally called Carolina in the West Indies. And it was just happened to be on the mainland. And that a racially, a slave society that came and developed thereafter a racially based formal caste system backed by law and extra legal violence has been with us all the way up into living memory, of course. Mm-hmm. And that is not to beat on the Deep South, but it is a rather horrific legacy, which is hard to square with American democracy. And the reason it was possible is because these Barbados planters were coming and embracing republicanism, but the republicanism of the ancient world, of classical Greece and Rome, which were slaveholding states in which a small oligarchy had the privilege of practicing democracy, and everybody else's, vast majority of the population's natural born lot was to be enslaved, and that was perfectly normal. And in fact, they believed, and their great intellectual leaders argued right up into the 1860s, that is the only way a republic could survive. This is the virtuous example handed down to us by the ancients. And indeed, many things have changed about the Deep South, but underlying it, it is still a society which is structured and whose leaders invoke policies which have society designed around the needs of the oligarchy, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And that somehow, if the oligarchy gets to do whatever it wants, don't worry, that'll be best for all of you. And that's the opposite, the antithesis of the Yankee model. I mean, you couldn't find two greater opposites than those two, really, on those grounds. Mm-hmm. One's about sort of individual denial, and, you know, you're in the classic Yankee frame. If you're, you know, incredibly wealthy, you're supposed to be a little bit quietly ashamed of it, and, you know, don't drive a flashy car and show it off, because somehow that's considered naff.
Right.
Whereas in the Deep South, that is absolutely not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, those are different dominant cultural prescriptions on you know, fabulously wealthy people living in both areas.
Mm-hmm. Those columns on the plantation manor houses.
Yes, yeah, so all classical.
Yeah. Athens, Georgia.
Absolutely. I mean, the in the Tidewater, you saw that too in Jefferson's house.
Jefferson,
that was an Enlightenment model where you were the gentleman aristocrat, and there somehow there was a social contract between you, the head, and your hands out there. Not in the Deep South. I mean, there was no. At no time was there a pretension towards that. And nor, you know, when Samuel Huntington talked about how the American creed that holds us all together has to do with the Calvinist Protestant work ethic. Nonsense.
Yeah.
I mean, you will never find in the deep Southern, oligarchies and slaveholders a great emphasis on how they felt they needed to work all the time. They were happy to be involved in leisure and saw no problem with that, mm-hmm. whereas the elite in Yankeedom was constantly haunted by the idea that they stop working for a moment. You know, that their spa towns, when they'd go off on vacation and enjoy themselves, no, they were really at a spa town for their health. You couldn't even admit to taking a vacation for much of the 19th century.
Right. No, that's quite right.
So haunted by the notion that they would not be one of God's elect if they weren't busy every minute and taking their money and, you know, investing it in building libraries or, you know, endowing Harvard or whatever it was, you know, had to be busy at all times doing things.
What a curse.
The cultural assumption, right? So, but, you know, that the Deep South, absolutely not. You know, that was not emphasized. And the final culture, Greater Appalachia, that was also not a priority there, but it was founded by, because the going back to the Midlands and the early Quakers had this open immigration policy, one of the groups that came in the largest numbers and settled in the backcountry behind the Midlands and spread across the Appalachian mountain range and on into great stretches of southern Ohio, much of Indiana, southern Illinois, southern Missouri, northeastern Arkansas, and on to the into east, you know, Texas and the hill country, a big sprawling Greater Appalachia. This was founded by people from the war-torn borderlands of the British Isles, mm-hmm. from Lowland Scotland, the English Marches, and Ulster. People, Lowland Scots, who had been brought from the lowlands of Scotland to Ulster to basically because they'd been living for centuries in this war-torn region of anarchy where you couldn't count on the rule of law to protect you, and there's constant violence, and you got to protect you and your kin from the outside, and there's no sense in investing too much in long-standing institutions because everything's going to be destroyed next week when war breaks out again. You keep your wealth in your pastoral society. You keep your wealth in herds of animals, mm-hmm. because you can move them and, you know, get away from things, whereas your crops will just be burned and eaten by the next passing army. I mean, you know, this is in sort of lampooning form but that's essentially a warrior culture from an incredibly difficult place. And because of the environment it grew in, the emphasis was on individual sovereignty and individual freedom, that there be as few encumbrances on you as a person as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Again, kind of the opposite of Yankeedom, that
you
be free to do those things, and a culture that was comfortable on the frontier and comfortable with fighting off challengers, and be they Irish Cairn guerrillas in Ulster or the Indians of the Appalachian mountain range, you would be able to hold another violent borderland. You would be able to hold the frontier and move on when necessary, and keep your wealth in a form that was mobile, and be attracted to areas that were facilitated a pastoral lifestyle where you could move herds of animals around.
Mm-hmm.
And huge for the 1700s, the number of people who moved there were just staggering. It was one of the greatest immigration wave of all.
Yep.
And spread down that mountain range and has created a very different culture, both in the Midwest that we've been discussing, but one across that vast region that, you know, it's since been lampooned by, you know, Hollywood and pop culture as, mm-hmm. you know, hillbillies and rednecks and NASCAR people. Mm-hmm. But it's a very proud culture, a libertarian strand that's extremely strong, but also a resentment of anybody trying to come in and lord over mm-hmm. People. And that meant they were hostile to the Yankees and their ridiculous moralism of, you know, trying to tell them, oh, you can't drink on Sunday, and meddling in things out of our way. You know, what do you mean individual self-denial? You know, you people are insufferable. And also of the rigid hierarchical world of the planters of the Deep South and the gentlemen of the Tidewater was mm-hmm. also not to their liking. So what's, you know, we talk about the South. What's forgotten is that during the lead up to the Civil War, and indeed during the Civil War, Appalachia, by and large, took the Union side. I mean, the reason yeah. there's West Virginia is the people right. of Appalachian Virginia seceded and joined the Union and fought for the Union. Mm-hmm. Kentucky didn't leave the Union. Mm-hmm. The eastern part of Tennessee tried to secede just like Western Virginia from the rest of North Carolina and become a separate state. Ditto with the highlands of Alabama. We're going to be the free state of Winston. In fact, more people from the Appalachian states, the Appalachian territory served in the Union Army by far than in the Confederate one. They fled and joined units and fought under the banners of their own states. Mm-hmm. It's only during Reconstruction, when the Yankees showed up in this sort of Iraq-like project that we've defeated you militarily on the battlefield, now we're just going to show up and remake you in, you know, a year or two into being like us.
Mm-hmm.
That did not go over well in Appalachia at all, mm-hmm. Including, you know, they had not fought to free the slaves. They'd fought because they couldn't stand the oligarchs back in the coastal areas that usually controlled their state governments. So they, mm-hmm. That's where the real Dixie coalition, which is still with us today, formed between Appalachia, Tidewater, and the Deep South, becoming one block, whereas where they were not. Yeah.
Interesting.
We've been through, I think, all of them.
We haven't talked about two that are to come later, and that is the Far West and Left Coast, I think.
Right. So briefly, the Left Coast came next. That's the Pacific Fringe, a Chile-shaped nation stretching from about Monterey, California, all the way up to Juneau, Alaska, and hugging the coastal plain on that side of the mountains. It was founded by two groups of people in essence and became a hybrid culture of the two. And those were Yankees arriving by sea who settled in the towns. And again, these were the Yankees were under this, you know, many where they were arriving on this mission to save the Pacific for to be create a new New England on the Pacific and to save it for the Calvinist work ethic and so on. And they founded places like, you know, Berkeley and mm-hmm. And Stanford. And their project, though, was, although that sort of utopian idea of kind of creating a more perfect society, you know, nice California dream kind of thing, mm-hmm. stayed. The Yankee project was overwhelmed by a second group of settlers, first attracted by the gold rush, but moving on from there, coming generally overland by wagon across the horrors of the far west, where there was no food and water, roads, and it was incredibly remote, and arriving on the left coast and generally settling in the countryside. And they tended to be from Appalachian parts of the Midwest and brought a emphasis on individual freedom and self-actualization. So you have a utopian mission bonded with trying to seek, you know, your individual potential, and that's become a very fecund combination.
Mm-hmm.
It's no accident that the Left Coast is the home to virtually every high-tech company you can think of that dominates the world today. Amazon, Google, Twitter, mm-hmm. Facebook, Microsoft, all of Silicon Valley's there. Apple, I mean, they're all there, and I don't think that that's really an accident.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Left Coast since its foundation, because of that shared Yankee tradition and utopian purpose, has been Yankeedom's greatest ally over the past 150 years, lining up with Yankeedom on every single issue
yeah.
and political item ever, mm-hmm. and set off dramatically in voting habits from the interiors of its own states, mm-hmm. which belong to the far west, which was the last of the Euro-American nations to be founded, because the interior west, we're talking about from around the 100th meridian on to reach the coastal mountain ranges was such an incredibly hostile place in the late 19th century when it was finally colonized. It was remote, it was arid, it was high altitude and cold. In order to survive there, you had to have access to huge amounts of capital generally, and therefore it could only be settled by and large through the interventions of the federal government or large corporations located on the coastal nations, railroad companies, deep earth mining companies, the building of irrigation infrastructure and dams, and so forth. And so it was, you know, the railroad companies built the railroads first and then guided and controlled settlement. They gave out the land grants and created the towns and often recruited entire boatloads of people in Europe with advertising and special ships and rates to colonize their area. You know, it wasn't the other way around. But the thing was that because they were sort of dependent, it's kind of like Avatar, you know, they arrive on Pandora and they have to, you know, ride around in the back of this giant piece of industrial capital, you know, tearing up the forest, you know, that dependent on it and resentful of that dependence. And they were exploited as a internal resource colony through much of our history in all sorts of, you know, detailed in the book, but all sorts of awful ways and, you know, railroad rates being set up to keep the region always in a state of dependency on the coasts. And that, resentment of both the federal government and outside capital has resonated in politics, and the emphasis was on the outside capitalists in the up until the 1940s, you know, the Anaconda Coppers of the world. It was, you know, a lot of big populist politicians came out of the region. More recently, it's joined in a sort of alliance with the Dixie Coalition because they've emphasized the resentment of the federal government's intrusion on things. So that's the Far West, which extends on up into much of interior British Columbia, most of Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, those parts of Canada. And there's a final nation, which is either the oldest or the newest nation, depending on how you look at it. I call First Nation. It's up there in the little parts of Alaska, but much of northern Canada. And Greenland. It's an area much larger than the contiguous United States, and it is a region where the original Aboriginal inhabitants or Native Americans or Inuit-speaking people generally never signed treaties with anybody else giving away their land. And in recent decades, that's been recognized in Canada's courts, and the Kingdom of Denmark has always been cognizant of that, and they've therefore been gaining through Supreme Court decisions and decisions of the Danish Parliament, which controls Greenland, enormous autonomy over their own affairs and what happens in the region that borders on sovereignty. Nunavut, the territory of Canada, of course, is dominated by Inuit-speaking people and is a sort of a nation-state of sorts. And Greenland is standing on the verge of full independence and is the only part of all of North America where an indigenous language is the language of state. And a fascinating place I've been able to visit, but that's if you ever wondered, you know, what if we hadn't wiped out, in quotes, the Indians of North America and they still had control of affairs, what sort of solutions and what sort of cultural take would they have had on 21st century challenges of the world? We may be able to find out, because
there it is.
Greenland, these other places, they're about to do so. And they're Greenland, nobody owns land. I mean, everybody's house is built on communal land. You can't own it any more than you can own the air, for instance. And yet they're negotiating with mining companies and, you know, preparing to exist, hopefully on their own terms with the outside world. So it'll be fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
And there you are. There are the nations.
Colin, that's amazing. This is really an excellent book, and I congratulate you on writing it, and I thank you for writing it. I hope that every American and everybody interested in America reads it. I think there's a ton of insight in it, and I know that I learned a lot about my own misperceptions as to what I am and where I have lived. Much of what you write in the book is very resonant to me. As I say, I've lived in almost all of these regions. I have not lived in New France, and I have not lived in First Nation, but I've lived everywhere else in the United States, and it really does ring quite really very, very true to me. We've taken up so much of your time, I don't want to take up any more, but I do want to have the opportunity to ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
I wish I could say I had a new book project fully formed. I'm still gestating on what I would like to commit to, you know, a multi-year project to next. So at the moment, I'm still, you know, using this paradigm to analyze and talk about current events as they unfold. We had a presidential election coming, and the regional paradigm offers fascinating insights on various things that happen. All the way down, for instance, today's mission is the Ohio vote, which repealed the ban on communal bargaining state workers. Fascinating, because Ohio is divided between three nations. It's really interesting looking at the voting patterns across those. So I'm doing a lot of that these days in the short term and still thinking about what my next book project might be.
That's refreshing, actually, that you're thinking about what to do. Yeah. Almost everybody I interview says, actually, I have this project. It's almost fully formed. Here it is. So anyway, thanks again for writing the book. It's a terrific book. And Colin Woodard, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Colin Woodard about his new book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.